Welcome to Technology Tangents. We get leaders together to discuss the important tech of today and the implications for tomorrow. Our discussions are fun, lighthearted, and frankly opinionated, but hopefully gives you a sense of what matters, what to pay attention to, and what to ignore. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning.
How are you this morning?
I am still waking up. It's only been 5 cups of coffee, but we're getting there.
Okay, five in, you're getting closer to being useful.
Well, and close to your mom.
Close to my first coffee of the day, exactly. Yeah. Jason, good morning.
Good morning.
I see you have coffee in front of you, so you're sat now or you're behind?
I'm still protesting the Monday morning podcast schedule, but yes, I'm
the
here.
The coffee shop downstairs what is it grateful.
What is it when you're about to go on strike, but you don't? Yeah, you just like notify people.
Put it
I don't remember
notice.
What that's called, but
you're putting us on notice.
Yes.
Well, I'll tell you, the coffee shop downstairs is the one actually sponsoring our podcast going to Monday morning so that you buy some extra.
Right.
Well, this morning I want to talk to you guys a little bit about retooling. In short, if OECD, which is the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, if you're not familiar, it's that international organization that works on better policies for better lives. If their estimates are to be believed, they think that in the coming decades, millions of workers will need to be entirely reskilled, not just a little bit, but entirely reskilled, thanks to our favorite AI. That's really the core of the question is, let's assume that's true for a second. What does that look like? How does it work? What does it even really mean? I think is what I'd love to dive into. Look, just to start, we could start off this question pretty straightforward, which is if AI is really a paradigm shift, how do people need to retool? What does that even mean? Any thoughts?
It's such a broad topic. I think retool in what sense, right? It's very different for a developer, for example, to retool than it is for a financial analyst to retool, than it is for a host or a hostess in a restaurant to retool. Yes, there's some impact to everyone, I believe, but it will be varying depending on in which role. So do we want to narrow it to one specific set of roles?
Well, I think that's good. Yeah. In fact, I found some stats. The average half-life of skills, and again, this is a wide swath of skills, is now less than 5 years. So people are having to reskill every 5 years, upskill effectively every 5 years because the half-life is decreasing. In some tech fields, the ones that we work in, of course, it's now as low as 2.5 years. And so the assertion would be something like, let's focus on tech. And if that's true, the question becomes like for millions of workers then who work in tech today, upskilling may not be enough by itself. And this is the idea of like truly retooling them.
I'm not even sure it's 2.5 years for tech. I mean, we've seen this increasing from mainframe to client server to, mobile to cloud. And then the various cloud technologies coming along and getting adopted faster. Those come out, yearly now. And I think, our technology consultants have to be really constantly looking at, what's the new thing in from Google or Amazon or Databricks or new programming language or new libraries from Python, right? Whatever it is, they're really in, I'd say, constant upskilling mode.
Interesting question. My mind races a lot of different ways from even the concept of retooling. I feel like that as a professional, particularly as a knowledge worker, we're doing that all the time. And I think we're probably doing it in ways that we don't even understand. As I often do go back to more macro themes, and I'm intrigued by this moment because we have different things happening in society, whether it be declining birth rates, whether it be education changes where we seem to be focusing lower, especially in the US, much lower STEM scores across the board, much more focus on different elements. A lot more questions about leisure, a lot more questions around what is even the role of work, 32-hour work weeks. And so, I think what's going to be interesting is that we're starting to see, I think, a bigger gap between what I would say knowledge workers, folks that need skills, whether that be across different disciplines, and a lot of, more, I don't want to say hourly jobs for a classification of what that is. And I think what's interesting is that I think for many people, when you think about over the last 100 years, as you moved off the farm and went into more into jobs, it was typically going into jobs where you used your skills, your intellect, your training to work through that. And I think right now we're almost seeing a bit of a element of like, well, no, you don't need to do that. There'll be someone that does that for you or something that does that for you. Therefore, you should be going more into a service related type job. And I think what's going to be curious to me is going to be, well, what happens if that gap continues to expand, and what does that really look like? Because I think for many people that pursue, I'll just keep on using the broad classification, knowledge worker, I don't think the motivation is just simply, what they're doing. It's learning, it's curiosity, it's impact. It's all those different elements that I don't believe just a tool will take that away from us. And so when it comes back to retooling, you know, Jason, you mentioned the last 20 plus years of technology changes. I mean, I think they've all impacted, particularly the technology worker. I think the question, one thing we have today on a business is really around, well, how much is this going to change? You could make an argument that over the last 20 years, most companies have been technology companies one way or another, right? From how people use and how you serve your customers. And you know, now it's going to be curious to what that's going to look like. And yeah, so maybe the question for me becomes, I don't think we're going to handle the more macro societal issues in this podcast. It really becomes a question in my mind. I was like, well, what's the obligation of the company to retool your employees' workforce versus what's the obligation of your employees to be relevant? And that's an interesting question, I think, for companies to be asking today.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And, you know, I'm reminded of this idea that historically, maybe not in the past 12 years, we had zero interest rates. So everybody's just been growing like weeds. But historically, the idea of retooling, reskilling has been a lot of just, frankly, marketing jargon, I think. It's really been used to sort of soften the blow of layoffs, soften the blow of restructuring, to sort of assuage the feelings of guilt that, you know, managers may have, or social responsibility, or frankly, just create a PR narrative back to that perspective. Today, though, we're seeing some companies talk about this movement of AI being truly the strategic imperative. That is, their organization will not exist in the future if they can't figure this stuff out. And so to your point, does it then become a company strategic imperative to actually retool all their people to be effective in this new workforce or not? Like, if you believe the first, you have to believe the second, said differently.
This is a, you know, the classic good to great. You know, what were those companies that were being looked at in the 70s and 80s? How many of them existed in the 2000s? How many existed now in 2020, 30? I mean, I think, right. Yeah, to me, we may say it's employees that are retooling, but I would actually make the argument, no, it's companies. You know, we've had a generation now of companies that have dominated. You know, Microsoft's dominated for two generations, but you think about, you know, where are the next emergence of companies and how some will evolve and they'll continue to retool their company, which that implies their employees and their products and their services. You're going to see the continuation of emergence of others as well. And so I think it becomes back, not surprisingly, to my role in this podcast, to strategy. It comes back to business strategy. What do you want to do? How do you look through that? And I think that you have to continue to evolve what you're offering. That includes what you offer to your customers, but then also how do you get the employees to be able to work through that? And then some of that will be retooling. Some of that's going to be finding different ones, different locations, different desires, and how that plays out.
I think that's exactly right. I think so. The companies definitely have to retool, to your point. Companies have to reimagine how they're doing. I think that's the strategic imperative that they're talking about. Given that the labor market's still tight, given that AI talent is sparse because it's so new in many domains, do you have the option or do you have to sort of go for retooling your own people? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I like the view of retooling as a company, retooling itself in terms of different product services, how it delivers them, right? You know, Google has developed a lot of new technologies in how they deliver their services, which have been then adopted more broadly by the industry, for example. So I like that idea. I think so, Vincent, I think your question is more around retooling employees. Is the company responsible or should be driving that versus employees driving it? And my answer is, this really doesn't change the way that's always worked, right? Yes, companies have some responsibility to say, these are the things we're going to use, and here's some training that is, you know, for them that is provided. But employees have to, you know, make use of that. And so that's really on them to, I think, own their own career and go after those things. But I also think there's a temporal aspect to this in that, you know, following kind of the fusion of innovation, right? There are going to be, you know, when by the time a company gets identified and gets training and training plans in place, like that's, you're now in at least in the majority, you know, late majority or early majority, if not late majority of that, you know, the people that are really going to be truly, you know, on the leading edge of that, they're going to retool themselves.
Yeah. Wasn't it just the corporate version of helicopter parenting? Right. I mean, the company's job is to continue to be relevant in the marketplace. Company needs to find employees and technology and services that allow you to do that. If you can do that with your existing employees that know you, that are the right character that you're aware of, that's awesome. If you don't have the existing workforce that doesn't have that, you find that. And I think that's where it's going to be some combination of hiring, some combination of buying other companies that have that, some combination of retooling. But I think what is interesting today is this idea that now, no, the company has a social obligation to make sure that all your employees can still be relevant. And I think that's a shift in what we're seeing today in society that goes back to, it's always someone else's responsibility to make sure it happens. And I think whether, and it makes sense from a governmental perspective, because as we've seen over the last 4 or 5 years that, I think there's a significant change in terms of the backstopping and what we expect to happen. So if you're the government, we can't backstop everyone. So therefore companies need to do that. So I'm not trying to go on a, down a path of things that we can't fix, but to me, you know, I think it's in the company's best interest if they know their employees, you want them to be here. But the same token, I agree with you, Jason. I think that employees have to continue to own their part of that. And I think it's not simply saying, do this or do that, or otherwise we ultimately get to, I think, Vincent, where you were positing a second ago, where this is typically marketing spin for, you know, trying to do RIFs and reductions and things like that.
And sometimes, you know, employees don't want to do that, right? They don't, you know, want to retool. I have a good friend, this is a long time ago, but he supported a lot of the old legacy mainframe TPF platforms at a company I used to work for that's a heavy user of TPF. As we were retooling, and I think one of the big things that employees have as a potential benefit over a new hire with skills is knowledge of the domain. And so if they will reskill themselves, then I think they do have a leg up on an external hire. Like in this case, a friend of mine, he's like, yeah, no, I'm just not interested. So I'm going to go work somewhere else that is, you know, does legacy mainframe maintenance. And because I'm not interested. I've got maybe 10 years left in my career and I don't want to reskill. So I think that even the idea that it's the company's responsibility, it doesn't take into account that not everyone may want to do that. Again, that's why I think they have to offer it, but then employees have to opt in and they have to be responsible for doing it. And then others may choose to go elsewhere.
There is an alternative, which I think we alluded to a second ago, which is that you just don't. You just hire new people who already have the skills. I mean, we're seeing a huge amount of money being spent on reskilling their people, right? So according to one study, it suggests that such improvements for upskilling their workforce represent as much as 1.5% of the total budgets. It's a huge investment on trying to retrain your people with these new tools. I mean, and you're seeing people do it. So Amazon, of course, through its machine learning university, has enabled thousands of employees, allegedly, who had little experience, who are now experts in the field. Again, allegedly. But I mean, my point here is they are investing a huge amount. They are putting the people through it. People are putting the effort in. In that same study, we see that 68% of workers are aware of the coming disruptions in their fields and are willing to reskill to remain competitive. Is that something where you have to do it on your own, or is it really the company's responsibility? I'm just going to push on that a little bit more, which is to say, look, I agree, people will have to retool, they'll have to reskill, they'll have to learn how to use this technology. Is it the company's obligation, or is it, as an employee, is it your obligation to remain competitive in the workforce to go learn how to use the new technology? Through Udacity, through Coursera, through whatever means you want.
Well, I don't like the word obligation, okay, right? It's to your benefit as a company, sure, to offer it, because you keep the domain knowledge in-house. It's to your benefit as an employee to go get it, because not only, you know, do you get the next position
I hear you, but my point is really our company. So let's say that you make widgets, whatever widget you make. Are you really the best position to retrain your people, or should you outsource that to somebody who specializes in education?
That's just that you're talking about how now.
Yeah, I'm talking about how. That's probably my obligation though. As an employer who makes widgets, should I be the one that feels responsible? How about I use a different word? Responsible for providing the training for all of my people, or should I tell them, hey, you need to go figure this out. It's important.
That's not the only two options. My answer is should you be responsible for them doing it? No. But that doesn't mean you can't say, hey, we really like you, want you, you understand our business, you've been, understand the domain. Here's an opportunity we can pay for this. Just like you would pay for a high performing employee to go get an MBA, mm-hmm, right? Is that your responsibility or your obligation? No, but it does benefit you to do it, right? So there's not, I see that as a
false dichotomy.
Yes, exactly. It's not just those two options.
I mean, I agree with Jason. I don't often do that.
Whoa, wait, what? This is the last time I agreed with him. This time he agreed with me. We're going to have to definitely stop doing this on Monday.
That's why you guys know. Now you know why I did these on Monday. Exactly. Well,
But I think what's interesting is it's a really around, you know, some of it is word choice semantics. What does it look like? And I think that, you know, I think it's an interesting question around, are you willing to, hey, are you as a company, how do you work with a workforce that isn't willing to change or isn't able to change? And does that mean they exit out? Does that mean that they stay stagnant? Does that mean the different roles work through that? I think that happens every day. I mean, I think it, you know, this idea of, you know, where maybe in a manufacturing or you're making widgets and you can do that, or, you know, you've definitely seen examples within tooling, whether it be manufacturing tooling, or whether it be in tooling within technology, that at some point you having domain expertise and older technology becomes a competitive advantage for you as an individual and as a company. Mm-hmm. But I think for the masses, you know, you think about this, you've got a generation rising right now that have been on digital devices their entire lives. Well, what does that look like for a company? How do you take advantage of that? How does that change? I mean, you know, I think we're seeing some of that even where, you know, post-COVID, I think accelerated some of that. I think it's fascinating to see a bit of the rise of the gray hairs, you know, when it comes back to hybrid policies or not. I mean, I think it's going to be really interesting how the next, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 years look like as people come in who are accustomed to a certain type of work environments, work style, great flexibility. What companies fully embrace that? What companies go back to much more a rigidity? And I think right now, I think we've talked about this probably 6 months ago. We were probably sitting here saying, well, hybrid's going to all be the rage and it's going to offer flexibility. And 6 months later, now you're seeing companies consistently go back to, no, you're going to be in person. We're going to work through that. How does that play out? And so I think that this is a very interesting time right now where a lot of organizations are trying to figure out what's next. I think that, you know, generally, as we've talked about in this podcast over the last few months, I mean, I think AI is going to usher in lots of changes, and I think it's going to be in the best interest of both companies and individuals to figure out how that works through it to help you can have greater productivity, how that plays out and creates new things. I mean, this is a tremendous opportunity for creativity and curiosity. And I think companies and employees that embrace that are going to survive and thrive. And those that don't, you know, it'll be interesting to see what happens. But I think that's been around from the start of time.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. To the extent that people do get reskilled, retooled, and they start leveraging, you know, these new technologies, organizations more broadly, who's responsible for identifying those automation or those efficiencies? Is it the company saying, hey, in your job, you need to use this tool now to do this thing? Or is it really the employee's obligation to do that? Again, I know you don't like the word obligation, but whose responsibility is it?
It's funny because I normally like to think about the future, but I keep on finding myself going back to the past on these themes. Like, I'm thinking about, as much as a Midwesterner can, what early Silicon Valley looked like and how that played out. I mean, I think you went and you left environments to where you couldn't do the things that you thought you'd do. You left the bigger companies or the academic institutions to go to the garage and to create elements. I think you'll continue to see that. I think that a lot of innovation has always occurred to where people have either figured that they can do it faster on their own or through their own with less constraints. I mean, and we were talking about this earlier this morning, just around what's the role of legal complexity within these different themes and what companies are going to be held accountable to that, to whereas it's going to be easier to go and do it on your own and be able to have potentially less restrictions. And I think that will continue to play it out. And it's going to be interesting to see how companies kind of work. What do they develop themselves versus what do they acquire versus, you know, what emerges out of the muck a bit to companies that are tomorrow that we don't even know exist today.
That's a really interesting point, which is, are you saying sort of the broader statement that by and large, historically, innovation hasn't actually occurred within the organization from the company top down or bottom up from the employees? It's actually occurred outside the organization entirely.
I would say that. Or in best case, I mean, going, and Jason, you know this world much better than I do, but even going back to, again, if we just use early web technologies, I mean, you had a lot of the ideas did come from large organizations or government, but they didn't find sparks until they were out.
There are instances. I agree with Kevin that a lot of times, you know, those things come outside of big corporations. But, you know, occasionally a corporation will retool itself. Microsoft, right, did with cloud. Apple did with the iPhone. The question, it isn't a either or who's responsible to me again. So you have some companies, and in some of those companies, they'll have very visionary leadership that will define that transformation, and people will, you know, and they will be good at getting people. Usually those leaders are good at getting people on board. And you have some that have very good leadership that allow that bottoms up, right? And help encourage that transformation and define it. Then you'll have some where that won't be for either, right? And, you know, people will leave there and they may go found startups. And question to me isn't like who's responsible, but it's like what percentage. And my guess is that percentage will kind of be the same as it always is, right? Of things that will fall into each of these buckets. If you're saying like, what would I do?
Yeah,
like, what would you advise companies to do?
Yeah, where does success typically lie?
Yeah, I would advise them to try and capture those, like the innovation ideas from employees, and then to go drive that across the business, right? And that's what's worked. You know, there's not too many Steve Jobs out there that can reinvent a company. I think if you do that, otherwise those employees leave. So I do think someone within the company needs to like take ownership of the people that generate those ideas that are closest to the problem and work them through. That would be my encouragement to existing businesses. The strategy, Kevin's going to say, you know, you got to have a good strategy. And I think that's true, but a lot of this turns more into the how we get it done, right? And so when there's a strategy for like, hey, we're going to build a big search engine that can organize all the world's information, right? But the strategy, you know, the execution of like, oh, how do we build tools that scale across the globe and allow us to monitor and answer these billions of documents, queries in milliseconds, right? You have to like let the employees at Google, Microsoft, and a lot of these companies, you know, Facebook, if you look, they publish a lot of new technology, and not only do they publish it, they adopt it, right? And then once it's adopted, they open source it. And I think that is, if I were encouraging a company that wanted to transform, you know, with their use of technology, that's how I would recommend they go about it. But again, some will, some won't, some will, you know, some of those people will leave and start something new.
Yeah, one thing that's interesting around that also I think about this is I think a lot of what's been happening the last 20 years has really been consumer driven. And even if it's helped B2B perspective, but most of the technologies you think about what we've been working on, it's possible for when you go back to a company that this next season of change is going to be how we run more efficiently or differently internally. Think about all the, again, we joke about HR, accounting, finance, all these different processes, even training, all these different elements that have huge organizations to support them today. And really what many that are non-value added jobs, and I say that as someone who's in one of those potentially non-value added jobs. And I think that it'd be curious, like, well, how do you think about innovation within just how we actually run a company? And that may be an area where at least in the early AI, it's going to be a chance where it's more ripe. And then you'll continue to see the broader how that plays out to the services and products and services we offer. That could also be why it's where it's a bit more of a change right now, where in the technology field, they're more accustomed to having, you know, tools and technologies and approaches change more rapidly.
I think that's a good point. I do think there's a tremendous opportunity for driving efficiencies, you know, we'll call them internal facing systems and processes, you know, with macro situation, with interest rates super high and everything else. I think you'll see a lot of people doing that.
Yeah, there's no doubt there that you have to have some sort of benefit, economic benefit for the business these days that's pretty short term.
And by the way, I do think that one will probably be more driven top down because no one's going to volunteer to have their job removed.
Well, it's interesting you raise it because this really goes to the next question that I have, which is you're saying, look, it's a yes and at every point that I've asked, every question I've asked you guys so far, you're like, it's yes and. Is that really realistic though? Because to your point, a lot of the efficiencies, a lot of the AI gains will come from internal efficiencies, especially in the short term. It's just how do we do what we already do, but faster, better, cheaper? And you're saying, look, we have to enable, I think, Jason, you're saying we have to enable our people to raise their hand and say, hey, look at this great new efficiency gain by leveraging this new technology. My question is, like, how do you create the incentives to actually do that? Because as an employee, especially if I'm remote these days, if I can do my job in half the time because of AI, I'm not super keen on getting twice the workload. I actually would prefer to keep my same workload, do it in half the time and go mow my lawn or play with my kids or watch a movie. How do you actually create the incentives to do that?
Yeah, again, I'm thinking more from the developer perspective, less from some of these internal roles. The thing is, if you're get asked to go build, you know, something, right? Yeah, I want to go build this feature, this functionality. I want to go build this new tool. You have a set of things. What you end up doing is spending a whole lot of time doing non-value add, right? You know, and developers hate that. So they're always looking for ways to shortcut. Now, does that like say, oh, we're going to get rid of your jobs? No, because it's like, have you ever gone to the grocery store and picked out a potato? Like when you grab one, sure. all the potatoes roll down, right? Like they keep coming. The work that we have on our systems are giant mounds of potatoes, right? Like as soon as we take one, there's always another feature. There's a never ending backlog. And so it's like, well, I might as well, if I've got this a million items on the backlog, which I'm never going to complete, I might as well make them fun to do and not a bunch of painful. Now, I don't know if that's the same. Is the same is true for internal functions.
But even take the one you just said. Because I think in some ways you're sort of skirting around the issue very eloquently, which is to say, yes, I agree there is more work to be done. I think our overall productivity could increase. I think some crazy estimate I saw just the other day from The Economist, overall GDP is expected to increase by 3% thanks to technology. Like total GDP, total output of this country increased by 3% thanks to AI over the next 5 years. The question is, if I can do my set of tasks, my set of stories in half the amount of time, then no doubt there's a backlog of more stuff I could go do. But if I'm the one who has to raise my hand and say, hey, I got all my work done in half the amount of time, I may not really want to raise my hand and say, oh, I'll go do the next ticket. I'll do the next ticket. Now, some may, but on average, I'm not so sure, especially as you look at the culturally what we're shifting to this work-life balance to sort of the quiet quitting movement, et cetera, et cetera. How do you create the incentives within the organization so that people do want to raise their hand to take on and do twice as much work for the same pay?
Well, somebody's going to, right? Because they're going to want the promotion. They're going to want the, you know, this. Somebody's going to. And when they do, then that becomes the yardstick by which everyone's measured.
So you're trying to rely on this sort of game theory, Nash equilibrium, which is like, so long as at least one person does it, they'll stand out. And anybody who doesn't raise their hand will be punishing only themselves. And I think historically you've been right. That has worked out. I mean, this is true in school, right? Which is to say, everybody could just agree not to study for the exam and could go intentionally bomb it and get everything wrong. And the teacher would have to do something because they can't fail the whole class. And yet that never happens because kids inevitably, there's always one or two who are willing to do it. And then everybody else is forced to them study.
That person's name is Vincent.
But I mean, we are, at least it feels like today, the younger generation in particular is saying something very different. Collectively, and again, this might just be the vocal minority talking here, but collectively, whether it be on your favorite, you know, blind or fishbowl type application or from Wall Street Journal article, again, talking about generational differences of kids and parents vehemently disagreeing on if they should phone it in or if they should have the extra effort. You're seeing something that looks or at least again feels different than in the past. I don't know if that's still true this generation.
Do think it's a vocal minority problem, right? Or at least what people publish problem. Even on some of those sites, you can see what even people that work here post. And some of them, right, will say that, and some of them will take the other side. And I was playing Friday. We had a Credera golf tournament, which, by the way, my group won, which is, you talk about a rare event singularity. It's like I was on a golf team that won. That has like never happened before.
Well, I think you might have got confused. Lower scores are actually better.
I know. We got the lowest. Actually, we tied for lowest. I think we lost on the tiebreaker. But okay. But my point is, I you know, talked to a lot of our young consultants out there, and you know, most of them are at least, because a lot of this has to do with like that, you know, people want to be challenged and do interesting work. And you know, that's one of the, there's an old joke that around software that hardware gets faster, slower, then software gets slower.
Nice.
All right. So speed decreases over time.
Despite
our best efforts. And so, you know, I do think there's a little bit of that with AI in this issue. And again, I'm talking purely from the, you know, enterprise solution software development perspective, which is that the tools give great productivity gains, but the problems get harder and harder. And the problems get harder, I think, faster than, you know, at a rate faster than the productivity gains. Think about some of the things we see now that would never have been done, you know, self-driving, right? Those are super hard problems. And so I think some group of people will always generally be challenged to go solve these really incredible problems and are willing to work to do it. And that will set the bar essentially for everyone else.
I agree. I think it starts to be, where does that play?
That's twice in one day. I know.
Yeah, where competitive advantage fits. And you know, obviously there's an advantage of the large organization, right? We know that, we've seen this, but I think it's incurious because I do think it comes back to, I said it already this morning, character, curiosity, growth, what does that look like? And can companies mandate that? I think it's also going to be interesting a bit when you think about a macro world, right? Do you have certain parts of the world that are fostering this sense of exploration and learning and differently? You know, how does that play out? You know, how does it, you know, there's all these interesting themes, you know, going back to the generational differences, Vincent, you were talking a bit ago, and I think it's going to be, well, where does that persist? And all of a sudden that does create a generation that values, values different elements of work. And well, what happens when, you know, the game ends or the money runs out or something else, or, you know, parents aren't willing to pay for it anymore. Government's not willing to pay for it. Yeah. I mean, I'm not assuming massive kind of impact. I do think though, at some point there's going to be a rise for a company to be able to find employees that are intrigued by wanting to grow and to learn and how that plays out. And I think that may be where ultimately AI can be kind of interesting, because you start to cull a bit the herd for the folks that don't want to do that.
Can I take the other side of my own argument, by the way? What I was talking about was developers, but I think on some of the internal roles, you know, you talked about HR, finance, those type of things, that may actually be a little different. And it's something I hadn't thought of until you brought it up this morning. But, you know, because I tend to look at that view from what I do. And yes, there is always a ever-growing mound of potatoes, but to go do. But I think in a lot of ways, some of the internal stuff, that's a zero-sum game, right? There's only so much finance to do, no matter how big the company gets. And, you know, that might be a situation where people, you know, there are tons of operational efficiencies there, and it actually does come down to like, well, we need less people.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I think Mythical Man Month, and just, I think the work always fills itself magically to whatever time you give it. But the value creation will definitely be the...
And people may build solutions for that for companies, right?
Maybe. We'll see.
Nobody wants, you know, Oracle Financials or Microsoft Dynamics. They just end up having to get it, right? And so, is there a new... one of those on the future.
Okay. We got a trust buster over here. I feel it. I feel it.
Yeah. Yeah. Today's episode is sponsored by the lawyers. Exactly. Reviewing all that we said and said we can and can't do. This does go back to where I didn't want to go at the beginning of this, but you also think about, I do find it's interesting seeing different countries that are positioning for a 4-day work week or, elements of that, right? So it's curious of like, Well, what does that mean? What's the motivation behind that? Is that
what's wrong with 4 12-hour days?
Nice. This is exactly where I was going to go. If you look at the data, so I hear you, Jason, and I don't think what you said is on the face of it wrong, but I'm not sure the data support it, which is say, like, if you look at the data of people today, so this comes from the National Bureau of Economic Research, maybe reliable, maybe not, I don't know. Between 2019 and 2020, the number of hours people spent working in the US fell by 33 hours per year per person. So on average, in America, people work 33 fewer hours than they did in 2019. We're seeing the data suggest that people are actually working less than they did before. Now, the interesting thing is, again, maybe AI, rather than seeing a significant increase in total output and productivity of this country, maybe people just work less to output the same. That has its own intrinsic problems. But it comes down to this core question, like, if people can do more in less time, that is, like, the actual economic output increases per unit person hour, if you will, should employers pay more for higher output? Should employees get to work less? How do you, as an organization, think about this balance? Because I think it will be a very reasonable argument to say, well, look, I need a raise because I did twice as many stories, or I have, you know, my velocity is twice what it was 2 years ago. The organization benefits from that increased economic output. Why shouldn't I, as the employee?
I'll jump in. Well, Jason, you can maybe think about it from a velocity perspective on the tech side. I mean, I think that there should be choice on both sides. We're in a business, right, that we debate all the time. Do we get paid by output? Do you get paid by hours? And working through that. And I think that at the end of the day, the most fair thing to do is to pay by output. And so, you know, to me, if you can work half the time and use tools and have what gets done, well, then you can choose to have leisure. If you want to use that time to retool or to get more, you should be compensated from that. I mean, I think that's been the pursuit and the growth and the goal of business for, you know, the last 150 years. But what is interesting now is around, well, it's the artificial constraints that are being placed in. It's questions of, well, is it fair? is it equal? You know, well, if we restrict the number of hours that you can work, will that make, you know, the imbalance is not, I mean, there's a lot of other macro themes that start to eke their way in that have nothing to do with personal productivity or tools or what companies want to do. And I think that's what's also intriguing right now, because I think that maybe what success looks like is starting to change. And how does that, how do companies continue to evolve to where maybe employees have different perspectives, different desires, what it is. And now I think generally speaking, if employees want to work less and get fairly compensated for that, I think generally speaking, at least in the works, the business that you and I, the three of us work in, that's probably healthy for our employees. Other companies, it's actually probably pretty unhealthy, you know, if you're working a job where all of a sudden you want to work less and there's not going to be an increase in economic output for the cause of that. And so I think these are broader themes and what we're going to discuss on a Monday morning, but it's very intriguing about where this goes over the next few years.
It goes back to how much does the company want to grow? You guys won't remember this, but I remember before there were lawnmowers, okay? You know, there was a push, you know, a set of clippers that rotated on a blade and you pushed it. And it took me 2 hours to mow the lawn. Gas-powered lawnmower comes out and it took me 20 minutes, okay? So if I'm doing lawns, do you want to pay for 2 hours? I charged you back in the, I charged like $3 an hour, but you know, so, you know, it, like it was $10 to mow the lawn. Now it takes me 20 minutes. Do you still want to pay me $10? Right. Or in today's money, that may be 2 hours. Maybe let's say I charge you $100 to mow the lawn. Now it takes me 10 minutes. Do you want to pay me $100 for 10 minutes worth of work?
Well, since you've been around since before the combustible engine, I don't want to pay you because you're 152 years old.
There were engines. I'm just saying we didn't have a lawnmower.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, this is the sort of core point of inflation, which is like economic output increases, and therefore you end up with this dilemma if you don't have something like inflation.
Right. And what I'm saying is if the economic output, you know, if we're able to get a lot more done, mm-hmm. right, then those employees, right, okay, great. Yes, you're able to drive a lot more value. You should be able to get some value.
If though your sort of unit is aligned to that, right?
But my point is, like, if I'm in the lawn mowing example, like, yeah, maybe I only charge $30 now, mm-hmm. but what it allows me to do, right, is now I can do 6 in a day and I can make $180 instead of, you know, 1 in a day or whatever, right? And so that's how you end up getting paid more. Like, what I can't do, I don't think, is expect, and I don't think employees can expect to continue to do the one lawn and make more money.
Yeah. Well, this is, I mean, I think you're exactly pushing on the core issue here, which is like, can you do value-based pricing, like, or not?
And I get that all the young college graduates may want that, but like eventually they'll be in a position to run their own business and they'll realize how untenable it is.
Well, I think the challenge is though right now, so if you have your self-propelled lawnmower that allows you to do 6 jobs for $180 a day, you know, that's great. Well, then the person who's still rocking a clipping clippers, they want to get paid $180 a day too. And they're finding someone that says, well, you should still make that because it's fair for you to still make $180. Like, that's what's going on today, where, you know, how can you take advantage of the technical changes and the productivity gains when we're looking at the macro environment saying, well, I don't know, you should really be able to do that, and how you play through that. And again, I don't think anything's new here today. Yeah. Besides,
by the way, I don't think that that is fair for that person to get paid the same.
Well, I agree, but I think my point is that I think today there is people that would say that they should get paid the same regardless of one using automation and the other using non. And,
but by the way, why is it not fair? I want you to like unpack.
Well, you have every, you know, opportunity to go get a lawnmower too.
What if you don't? Like, what if those lawnmowers cost more? What if driving around to 6 lawns adds burden that you don't have access to a car?
But what I'm saying is, okay.
Well, the good news is in 2025, you can go to California with a push clipper and you have all the business you want.
Well, but I think like this is the core of the argument, I think, which is to say, look, imagine we take yours one step further, one generation into the future. My intuition is that robot mowers will do everything. And so now the question is, well, how much does a robot mower cost? Well, it costs more than a push mower costs today. And it certainly costs more than a powered mower, then it certainly costs more than a push mower that you're talking about. What if I, as a company now, can get a loan and I can spend $20 million to go buy a whole fleet of these things and have a semi that drives them around. And I drive around neighborhoods and I just deploy them, drop them off, they go mow the lawn, and I'll pick them up at the end of the day. So now I'm deploying and mowing everybody's yard. at a fraction of the cost because my marginal costs have gone to near zero. There's no way for anybody else to compete realistically because these things are expensive and to have the scale is difficult and all the things. And so again, there's the core of the argument on the other side of where you are, Jason, is saying like, well, that's not fair because that requires you to have all this capital investment up front. Therefore, we shouldn't do that.
Well, what's unfair about letting someone deploy? Look, we all want the benefits of it, right? Like I tell the story all the time about we have our family has a place on a lake in East Texas and we had fiber run to it and it took the fiber guy like 10 minutes to run the fiber because he could, I mean, this is a real world example, right, of yours, because they had this like electronic thing with a joystick that like dug a trench for the fiber in like 20 minutes. It was amazing, like 200 feet, whereas it would have taken 4 or 5 days to dig, you know, a trench by hand. You know, you're thinking only from the one side of that equation. The other side of that equation is how many people down that street want fiber? Like, so yeah, that one person who doesn't want to invest, doesn't want to make the investment or doesn't want to get the loan or whatever. What about the other 200 people on the street that want to get fiber this year? I would absolutely argue it's still fair.
But I think that the three of us would argue that we want that machine to create that fiber in 10 minutes. I'm not certain there's a lot of people in society that want that. They'd say, no, you should hire the 5 people and dig the trench and you can have it 2 years from now.
I don't know what to say to that. I really don't. I mean,
go fishing.
This is the thing. This is the little red hen, right? That's the story I used to read to my kids. Like everybody wants the bread, but nobody wants to bake it.
Yeah. So look, I think this comes down to this core question, which we're sort of like wrestling with a little bit here live, which is to say, you know, look, it's going to be a paradigm shift. It's going to require people to work differently. The question is, what do you do with that savings? So again, back to this point, should the guy charge the same as what somebody charges who has 5 laborers? Your point is like, no, he should charge less. And the question is, okay, if he charges less, then he makes less. Like, how do organizations think about the same thing within their own business?
This is no different than anything that has ever happened in the last...
I think it's the scale and the rate at which the adoption is taking place that makes it different.
The scale and, you know, the rate at which it's happening doesn't change the fundamental economics underlying it.
Agreed.
Right? And so it's the same when, okay, ATMs, right, came out, right? Like, what is it going to do to tellers? And what are all these things? Well, we work through it, right? Like, it's the same when, like, what an IDE comes out and, or an editor, an IDE comes out and we no longer have to type punch cards. How much more code are we going to write? Now, none of this, I think, has changed. The technologies don't change the underlying economics. Like, you're right. It is a broader impact across society and it is faster. What I don't think you're going to do, it's, you know, just like, one asteroid follows these laws. Now we have 100 asteroids. They're all going to follow the same law.
Yeah. Now, the point, though, I think just the core of the thesis today is really like who's bagging all these words, but I'm going to use them anyway because that's the only word I can think of. Whose responsibility is it? So to your point of the ditch digger, now the little robot thing, like is that the employee's job to figure out how to use that? Is the company's job to go buy the machine to make the investment to force him to use that?
Ultimately, in free markets, the market decides.
Sure. I don't disagree with that. The market will decide all of these, who the winners.
All of these different things that are happening, whether it's employees doing this or starting their own companies or companies doing that, like the market will decide the winners. I don't think there's a right or wrong.
No, I don't think there's right or wrong necessarily. I think the free market will decide. The point is, as our hope for the podcast is to advise the leaders of organizations, let me rephrase the question. What would you advise them to do? How do you position yourself to be the winner here? We'll simplify the question a little bit even further to the last question that I have for you guys today, which is there's really two ways that we've talked about. And I think these are the two ways that AI will transform businesses. The first is the internal efficiencies. How do you do the same things you're doing today, but faster, better, cheaper? And the second is really creating net new offerings for your external customers to allow them to solve novel problems or same problems in novel ways. Where should organizations start focusing? And you guys both keep saying both. So we'll assume the answer is both. But if you had to choose one to start focusing on, what would you advise people to do to sort of set themselves up to be the highest chance of success long term? Internal efficiencies or external customers?
He's biased us by saying we can't say both and yes and everything.
Well,
other.
No.
But I mean, I think
you can. My assumption is you will say yes and I'm saying great.
Yeah,
But where do you start?
I think right now it depends on what type of business you're in, right? So for our business, I think you have to do both internal efficiencies and external because we're offering professional services and we need to be able to do this. If you're not in a professional service business, I would argue that the gains internally right now are going to be faster, how we use proven technologies in a world that's growing, evolving really quickly to have greater efficiencies. It coincides with labor shortage. It coincides with greater retirements. I mean, there's a lot of other themes that would say that this makes sense. The contra or the potential concern is going to be around risk mitigation and how that plays out, and just seeing, well, what does the trust look like? You know, I mean, there's organizations are probably all over the map between where do you trust an automated solution versus some human capital intervention. But, you know, I think that just the way that, I mean, just, I mean, this is the way our customers are selling right now, our solutions right now, and this, again, this could be very short term, the next 3 to 6 months. I mean, they're buying, you know, acceleration plays for internal processes.
I'd say operational efficiency as well, but for a different reason, which is like, let that fund the customer. Money is not free anymore, right? And it takes some investment. Like, you've got to pay for that somehow. And so you can get some of this low-hanging operational efficiency and then use that to pay for the innovation.
Yeah. Turns out I'm in the same boat, just so you know. If you had to choose one to start with internal efficiency, I would say, for all the reasons you guys said, labor market's tough, money's not free, these have real costs, but also because there's going to be a lot of players out there doing a lot of different things and come up with novel use cases. I think the most important thing you can do, back to the theme of the pod today, you got to start retooling your people and re-gearing how they think about problems. And I think the easiest way to do that is to start letting them use this in their daily lives. I think you get better intuitions. Where does this work well? Where does it not work? What's frustrating about that? What's not frustrating about that? You also mitigate some of the legal implications, the ethical implications, if you have those as well. So I think it's just like the right place to start is there. That being said, I do agree with you. And I agree, back to the point of the question, I'm assuming you really need to do both in almost every business, at least medium term. But if you had to start with just one, I would start there. Awesome. Anything else you guys want to close with? Thoughts? Mondays are the
Really don't like Mondays.
I think we have a new Garfield meme coming out here. Okay, good. Got it. Well, thanks for joining us today. For those who would like to learn more, please visit the insights page at Credera.com. Bye-bye.